Some Protestants, such as born-again Christians, believe that one can be saved in heaven, assured salvation. Did early Mormons believe something similar? Was polygamy a ticket to heaven, not just for the man, but for his wives and children as well? Dr. Bill Smith will talk about this in our next conversation. We'll also talk about one of the major justifications for polygamy, raising seed. If that was so important, why did Joseph Smith not have any children with wives other than Emma? Check out our conversation. Before you do that, I just want to mention one thing. Our latest transcript with Dr. Noel Bringhurst is on sale now. We've got it for sale for just $6 this week only, so check it out on Amazon.com. Also, please remember to subscribe on our website. For $10 a month, you can get every transcript as soon as it is released. Now back to our conversation. Well, let's talk a little bit about, I know in 132 it talks about one of the purposes of polygamy is to raise seed. And one of the interesting things, and I've talked with Dr. Ugo Perego as well, we have not been able to identify any children of Joseph with a woman other than with Emma. And so it would seem, you know, that if one of the purposes is to raise seed, and certainly Brigham Young and some of the later prophets raised seed with multiple women, why didn't that happen with Joseph?
I can't really answer that, except to say that the record on the ground seems to suggest that, at least with some women other than his wife, he was having sex. But I think it's impossible to argue beyond reminiscent accounts, that sort of thing, whether or not that was really going on. I think it's probably a sure thing that it did happen. But with who and how often, that's really hard to say. And I don't talk too much about that in the book, except to say that one of the fundamental properties or points in the revelation is making babies, children. That's the point that the Book of Mormon makes about polygamy, is that the only justification or the justification the Lord offers in the Jacob narrative is that, you know, if the Lord decides he wants posterity raised up for some particular reason or other, then he can initiate polygamy. And I think the revelation speaks to that in the same way, that the primary point of polygamy is to raise children or to have children. The way it works and the way probably it's meant to work in the revelation, I don't know this for sure, but the way it actually worked is that polygamy tended to decrease the number of children per wife on average, but it tended to increase by a fairly large margin the number of children per man. So that this is a narrative of, and I don't say this in a negative way, it's a narrative of elitism. The idea is that the elite Mormon men, those maybe I could use the word assured salvation, like Joseph Smith, it was a great thing to be a child of somebody like that. Theoretically, it was a great thing to be their child because, as Joseph says, on the other side of the veil, I will claim what I seal. In other words, anybody he's sealed to is guaranteed to go into heaven with him, because he's guaranteed in the revelation, in fact, that he'll be going to heaven. So this is important. It's an important story for important people. That sounds doubly bad, I guess, in the present day. It sounds sexist and it sounds elitist, but in fact, that's the way it worked out. And so a lot of people engaged in polygamy, a lot of women engaged in polygamy, not as many men, of course, but it was really a story in terms of descendants, a story of elite Mormon men, because they're the ones that had 30 wives or 15 wives or 25 wives or more. And most of those men had children with most of those wives. At least that's a rough approximation.
So could you argue that it seems like, you know, Brigham Young and later people followed that commandment a lot better than Joseph did?
I think part of the reason for it, I think that's true, but part of the reason for it is the nature of polygamy in Nauvoo, extremely secret. They tried their best to keep it under wraps. It was obviously they didn't do a perfect job, but they tried their best to keep it under wraps. And I think meeting up with somebody in a small town, everybody's going to know about it. It's really hard to do that. Parley Pratt's exchange of letters with one of his plural wives in Nauvoo is sort of illustrative of that. He says, you know, I can't make it at 6 o'clock on this day. So we're going to meet up, presumably to have sex at 6 o'clock on this other day. And it was really hard to nail down assignations with your plural wives. And Joseph Smith is an extreme point of this. He's being watched by everybody. Everybody knows him. If he walks down the street, oh, there's Joseph. Why is he going into Sister So-and-so's house? Why is he going to their house? What's happening there? Oh, I saw him go in their house at night. What happened at that point? People are talking about that. We'll talk about this. And so that makes it difficult, I think, for him to engage in any extra Emma sex. And I think he did do that. But how much and how often, I think that's a function of his daylight personality. He's watched. He's observed. Not in the spy sense, but in the sort of neighborhood sense.
Yeah. That's interesting. So let's talk a little bit about the verses in there that directly address Emma. I read those, you know, that says Emma will be destroyed if she doesn't accept polygamy. And I guess it makes sense to me. Certainly, I believe those verses probably weren't meant to be public. But I read those things, and I try to imagine being in Emma's shoes. And it seems like she didn't put much credence in that. So can you talk about those verses and you know, how Emma reacted and how you feel about them? I mean, is that something that maybe we should... You know, could we excise that out of the DNC 132, or is it too late? We have to just have it because it's in there.
All interesting points. I think as far as the revelation is concerned, when I said I didn't think it was intended to be a public document, is because I think at the time it was of a piece. It was kind of a letter to Emma. But there are parts of it that are certainly theologically important to Mormonism and always remained that way and still do. Those parts, I think, are the ones that generally, not always, but generally appear in print. We don't reference, if you look at the pattern of reference to Section 132 in sort of general church meetings, it drops off heavily after the 1904-ish era. People are not talking about it publicly too much after that. They'll cite one or two verses out of the Revelation. If you look at the footnote history of the Revelation, the liminal texts like the headers and the footnote process that Orson Pratt started in 1876, he doesn't footnote. He doesn't try to relate those types of verses to anything else, usually. I think most of those overtly Emma sections don't get referenced, except maybe internally. See verse 6 where it talks about this or something. But they're not referenced to external passages. In other words, he doesn't try to justify the statements by referring to some biblical passage or some other revelation or the Book of Mormon or something like this. So I think it was Joseph F. Smith sort of expressed, I think, the opinion of at least people who thought about the revelation, that this is 1870-ish, thought about the revelation, that the revelation really wouldn't have, if it would have been made public in the normal way, like others of Joseph Smith's revelations, those parts would have been edited out. And I think that's true. I think, in fact, I was sort of bold in the book. I actually provide a sort of edited text of the revelation.
Oh, really?
So, yeah, have fun reading that. So, I think there's a big role for Section 132 in our current thinking about marriage, about how we deal, we'll say, with gay marriage or with the place of women in Mormonism. Section 132 speaks to that. I don't know whether, I'm not saying that it's interpreted the way I would like to see it interpreted, but it does find a use there. It finds a use in a justification of our dealing with those kinds of issues. But not the Emma parts, I don't think. Not most of them, anyway. Some of them, yes. Verse 63, for example, got referenced at the installation of President Nelson. He quotes the last half of verse 63 as a kind of explanation about where the place of women really is in the kingdom. And I think it's important as a historical document, and it's important as a present document.
Well, and since you mentioned that, because I know some people reference that on the Bloggernacle, and were some of them a little bit upset about that because they said that, you know, essentially Elder Nelson kind of quoted that out of context and left out some context.
Lifts out the first part of the verse, but I think the point is, at least for the book, the book's point is that this is an ongoing, interesting document. Mm-hmm. And unfortunately, one that people don't pay too much attention to, I don't think.
You don't think people pay attention to 132?
Not in the, I'm talking rank and file Latter-day Saints. I don't think they read it. It's, like I said, it's not referenced really. If you look at the from 1971 on to the current edition of the Ensign, if you look at references to Section 132, there are some, but it's very isolated. Nobody gave a conference talk about Section 132, for example. What's all in here?
Well, because we do talk about the new and everlasting covenant of marriage, but we talk about it in monogamy terms, not in polygamy terms. So, I mean, I guess I would say it's still very visible, but we do downplay the polygamy incredibly. Yes, I'll agree with that.
Yeah, that's my point. I think there are parts there. The revelation lies under, for example, our something that starts in, I think, the 1940s, this sort of families are forever kind of speech. That's all Section 132 is a text. The textual foundation for that is all that. But very isolated, in very isolated sense.
Yeah, we almost proof texted a little bit.
Not almost.
we want to show monogamy is very important.
Yes. Marriage is very important in Mormonism, and among Latter-day Saints, marriage is a very important thing. It impinges on basically all aspects of life in Mormonism. So, yeah, it's a fundamental theme and one of the painful themes for, say, singles in the church. So I talk a little bit about that in the book. So, that was a recent book, I think, by Carolyn Pearson, where she kind of documents some statements of women in the church about these issues. And I think that sort of verifies the position I sort of take in the book, is that this really has something to say, something to say about all kinds of things that are relevant. I don't say that in a sort of judgmental way. All I'm saying is that it's a relevant document. And so you have to deal with it whenever you discuss these issues.
I hope you enjoyed our conversation with Dr. Bill Smith. In our next conversation, we'll talk about how Section 132 might affect future revelations on women and gays.
It doesn't really speak to the possibility of gay marriage. It doesn't open that possibility at all. Whether it that could be addressed in some other way, I don't know, but the revelation doesn't, that's not on anybody's mind.
Right. So, I mean, do you see that as being a possibility of a future revelation?
Anything's possible. I don't know.
Thank you so much for listening. Make sure that you like our page on facebook.com/gospeltangents. You can subscribe at YouTube at youtube.com/gospeltangents. We're also on Twitter at gospeltangents, as well as make sure that you subscribe on iTunes so you don't miss any of our episodes. Thanks again for listening. Click here to subscribe, here for a transcript, and over here you'll see some more of our videos. Thanks again.